11. Okinawa Island, Japan, May 8, 1945, 1600 hours. 5,000 miles away from Los Alamos and just 400 miles from Tokyo, the American Marines know nothing about the A-bomb. The Germans have surrendered, they are told as the battle for Okinawa enters its sixth miserable week. The news quickly passes up and down the line from foxhole to foxhole. To a man, the response is the same. So what? Adolf Hitler is dead. The Marines are trying to survive. The worldwide war that the German Führer started 6 years ago still rages in this corner of the globe. The American military is moving ever closer to the Japanese mainland, but there is a high price to pay for that progress, and the Marines know it. The American island-hopping strategy began with the capture of the island of Guadalcanal in 1942, which put American forces within 3,000 miles of Tokyo. Capturing Peleliu in late 1944 put the Americans within 2,000 miles. The surrender of Iwo Jima closed the distance to 750 miles. Okinawa is half that. The next obvious assault will be the southernmost islands of Japan itself. We were resigned only to the fact that the Japanese would fight to total extinction on Okinawa as they had elsewhere, and that Japan would have to be invaded with the same gruesome prospects. Marine Corps Private Eugene Sledge will later write in a book about his experiences in the Pacific. The closer to Tokyo the Americans advance, the more brutal the fighting becomes. The invasion of Okinawa is already turning into the bloodiest and most costly battle the U.S. Army, Marines, and Navy will endure in either Europe or the Pacific. One notable casualty is legendary American journalist Ernie Pyle, winner of the Pulitzer Prize for Journalism in 1944, killed by a sniper's bullet through the temple shortly after arriving in the Pacific, after 4 years covering the European theater. Unlike the coral and jungle of Peleliu or the remote black volcanic soil of Iwo Jima, Okinawa is a well-populated island full of farmers. Its citizenry is a mixture of Japanese and Chinese. Many have already committed suicide rather than succumb to the invaders. The verdant fields of okra and eggplant that should be carpeting the countryside have been trampled by soldiers, cratered by shells, and littered with the detritus of war. Spent casings, empty food tins, burning vehicles, and of course, dead bodies. Footnote: Okinawa is 70 miles long and averages 7 miles wide. The island is part of the Ryukyu Archipelago, which Japan annexed in 1879. The island population at the time of the American invasion was approximately 450,000. An estimated 150,000 either committed suicide or were killed in battle. End footnote. The rich clay soil is now mud, thanks to monsoon rains. For the first time in many months, the Japanese seem to have an endless supply of ammunition and the big guns with which to fire it. Poncho-wearing American fighting men cower in their flooded foxholes or attack in the slop, their minds and bodies concussed by ceaseless shelling. The stench of rotting corpses carries on the warm subtropical wind. Many a man has slipped in the mud and found himself covered in maggots, face to face with a half-buried, decomposing Japanese or American soldier. All movements, Private Sledge will add, were physically exhausting and utterly exasperating because of the mud, and the ever-present danger of shells even far behind the lines. Sledge will note ruefully, "We tried to wisecrack and joke from time to time, but that always faded away as we grew more weary." Private First Class Desmond Doss would like to pray. The sun is rising. The men of B Company, 1st Battalion, 77th Infantry Division, are just moments away from assaulting the Mayada Escarpment, a 400-foot-high cliff stretching the 5-mile width of Okinawa. While the rest of the island consists of flat or rolling hills, the boulder-covered slopes are steep, and the last 60 feet are completely vertical. Within its limestone rock face, the Japanese have concealed a network of tunnels containing machine guns and artillery. From this vantage point, the enemy can monitor American troop movements in three directions, allowing them to lay down pinpoint artillery fire. It is vital that B Company capture the escarpment. Two full American divisions have failed to reach the clifftop. Now, instead of a full-scale assault, they will try stealth, concealing themselves among the boulders in order to reach the summit before they can be discovered. Private Doss asks his commanding officer if he can pray. "Sir," he says, "I believe that prayer is the biggest lifesaver there is. I believe that every man should have a word of prayer before he puts his foot on the rope ladder to go up that cliff." First Lieutenant Cecil Gornto nods. Doss is a devout Seventh-day Adventist who doesn't eat meat, smoke, drink, or work on Saturday. When he was first inducted into the Army on April Fool's Day, 1942, Doss's behavior was seen as eccentric. Fellow soldiers shunned him. Doss was even offered a discharge on the grounds that he was mentally imbalanced. He refused the ticket out. Since then, the rail-thin Virginian with the thick twang has distinguished himself at the battles for Guam and Leyte in the Philippines. His gallantry has earned him 2 bronze stars for heroism under fire. The men of B Company are no longer wary of the 26-year-old's devout ways. Doss prays aloud just moments before battle. Although some men do not join in the prayer, they respect the private. He is the company medic and the man who might save their lives today. On both Leyte and Guam, Doss amazed his platoon by running through thick enemy fire to drag men to safety. For the same reasons PFC Desmond Doss has become a hero of the men of B Company, he is also a target. "The Japanese were out to get the medics," Doss will recall of the white armband with a red cross on his left bicep. "They were taught to kill the medics for the reason it broke down the morale of the men, because if the medics were gone, they had no one to take care of them." Most remarkably, Doss is also a conscientious objector, meaning that he believes quite literally in the words of the Sixth Commandment, "Thou shalt not kill." For PFC Doss, war does not excuse him from following this law that he believes was handed down from God. But he is a patriot, and turned down a job in a shipyard back home so he might march alongside his fellow Americans. Doss does not carry a firearm. While the other men of B Company attack the Japanese with grenades and carbines, and among the medical corps most carry a pistol, Doss does not. "Amen," Doss says, completing his prayer. He knows the men are looking at him, hoping to draw comfort from his normally calm demeanor. Doss, however, is terrified, and there is little he can do to hide it. "Amen," add the men standing around him. It is dawn, and the temperature on Okinawa is still cool as the men of B Company move out. Within hours, having safely avoided detection, they reach the top of the escarpment, scaling the last 50 feet and then dropping ropes back over the side for other Americans to follow. Not a single man is killed, and the men of B Company know the reason why. "Doss prayed," marvels one incredulous soldier. But suddenly, the first cry of "Medic!" echoes across the rocky hilltop. As the rain continues to pour down on Okinawa, the rest of the world waits. Pockets of war still exist in places like Borneo and China, but Okinawa is the linchpin of the final American campaign against Japan. The last great battle of World War II cannot begin until this contest is settled. Footnote: 5,000 of the American dead in the Battle of Okinawa are sailors killed in kamikaze attacks. An additional 1,000 more Americans will be pulled off the line with shell shock from enduring the prolonged Japanese artillery bombings. Japan's Okinawa casualties will number more than 100,000 dead soldiers. End footnote. In Moscow, Russian leader Joseph Stalin is watching the Okinawa battle carefully. He is also making plans to transport 1 million men the width of the Soviet Union once the winter snows melt. Now that the war with Nazi Germany has ended, Stalin is free to attack Japanese-held Manchuria in northern China. As American General George S. Patton has warned U.S. leaders, the Soviet dictator is America's next great enemy. He is proving this by his ruthless stranglehold on the nations of Eastern Europe, now occupied by Soviet forces. The Russian leader actually wants the war between America and Japan to drag on as long as possible, giving him more time to move his troops from Europe to Asia. It is becoming clear that as long as Soviet aggression remains unchecked, Stalin will expand his empire as he pleases. In Washington, President Harry Truman is keeping a close eye on Joseph Stalin. Unlike his predecessor, FDR, he does not trust the Soviet leader. On May 11th, Truman ceases the U.S. Lend-Lease program with the Russians. The Soviet reliance on American trucks and other materials of war, which has been in effect throughout World War II, will soon come to an end. Though the United States and the Soviet Union still consider themselves allies, Harry Truman has given the first indication that America will not tolerate Stalin's brutal global ambition. An early casualty of the Okinawa battle is the USS Indianapolis, which now rests in dry dock at Mare Island Naval Shipyard in Vallejo, California. Her crew of 1,196 is enjoying an impromptu break from the war. Some have traveled home to see loved ones, while others spend their days in the nearby barracks playing cards. All of them are lucky to be alive. Indianapolis, a heavy cruiser, was nearly sunk by a kamikaze pilot off the coast of Okinawa on March 31st during the pre-invasion bombardment. Dropping down in a vertical dive, the suicide bomber loosed his ordnance just 25 feet above the ship. The kamikaze dropped only one bomb, but that was enough. The explosive penetrated the deck armor, then passed through the crew's mess and the ship's fuel tanks before exploding deep in the bowels of the vessel. 9 men died instantly. The blast blew 2 enormous holes in the hull. Indianapolis might have sunk right then and there if not for the damage control crews, who immediately sealed off the flooded compartments. Miraculously, the cruiser then sailed 6,000 miles back to San Francisco for repairs under her own power. Once upon a time, Indianapolis was a jewel of the American fleet. President Franklin Roosevelt enjoyed his time aboard her teak quarterdeck so much that he requested it as his personal transport for numerous transatlantic crossings. Its reputation as a special ship was solidified in December 1941 when Indianapolis set sail from her berth at Pearl Harbor across from the ill-fated Battleship Roe. Footnote: Battleship Roe was the name given to the dockside location of American battleships in Pearl Harbor. 8 such vessels, all named for states, were in port on December 7, 1941, when Japan attacked. Nevada, Arizona, West Virginia, Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, Maryland, and California. The USS Utah was also in port, but moored in a different portion of the harbor at the time of the attack. West Virginia and California were later refloated and returned to service. The wreckage of Utah and Arizona can still be seen where the ship sank, as memorials to the men who died. The bodies of sailors within the sunken vessels have never been removed. End footnote. When the Japanese launched their surprise attack 2 mornings later, Indianapolis was safe at sea, 700 miles to the southwest of Hawaii. The American battleships Arizona, Utah, Oklahoma, California, and West Virginia were all sunk, with a loss of almost 2,000 lives. But now, Indianapolis's luck has changed. The kamikaze attack has rattled many of the crew, some of whom have requested transfers to other ships before it sails back into battle. The War Department, however, does not consider Indianapolis unlucky. They see her return to America as an act of providence. Even as the damaged vessel is being retrofitted with the latest in communications and radar equipment, the War Department has secretly chosen Indianapolis as the ideal vessel to transport the components for 2 A-bombs all the way across the Pacific, where they will be assembled and prepared for detonation on the island of Tinian. Not a single member of the crew, not even the skipper, Captain Charles McVeigh III, will be told the truth about the mystery cargo that will soon rest in Indianapolis's hold. General Douglas MacArthur does not know much about the A-bomb either. In Manila, which he has not left since his wife and son arrived, the general is eagerly planning the invasion of Japan. U.S. Navy Chief of Staff Admiral Ernest King and U.S. Army Air Forces Commander General Hap Arnold oppose the invasion, convinced that control of the sea and skies will eventually strangle the Japanese economically, making the massive loss of American life unnecessary. It is estimated that 5 million American soldiers, sailors, and Marines will be needed, as well as 1 million British troops. Casualties on both sides are projected to number anywhere from the hundreds of thousands to the millions. Footnote: the two-part invasion of Japan was collectively known as Operation Downfall. The first attack would be the invasion of Japan's southernmost island, Kyushu, called Operation Olympic. The second would be the invasion of Honshu, the island on which Tokyo is located. This plan was codenamed Operation Coronet. End footnote. MacArthur disagrees with his Navy and Air Corps counterparts. He believes that an island blockade will not result in unconditional surrender. He refutes the conventional notion that the Japanese are strong enough to put up anything more than a thin defense of their homeland, despite the fact that they still have 4 million soldiers in uniform and thousands of planes hidden throughout Japan for the specific task of carrying out kamikaze bombing. MacArthur believes his command of the largest amphibious landing in history will be successful. He sees glory. Others see death. A handful of generals from the European theater have been transferred to MacArthur's command, but America's most aggressive and successful general is not among them. General George S. Patton's war is over. The fiery tactician will remain in Germany to oversee post-war rebuilding, entirely unwelcome in a Pacific theater of operations. As one American officer puts it, two prima donnas, two colorful personalities in the same theater, were one too many. Footnote: there is nearly a 6-year age difference between Patton and the older MacArthur. They first met on September 12, 1918, during World War I's Saint-Mihiel Offensive. In 1932, MacArthur ordered then-Major Patton to disperse protesters who had occupied parts of Washington, D.C. Historians still debate as to who was the better general. End footnote. Ensconced inside his vast palace in Tokyo, Emperor Hirohito ponders whether or not to move to a secret mountain fortress that has been prepared for his safety. Japan's cities are in ruins. Hundreds of thousands are homeless. Hirohito's Imperial Japanese Navy has been almost destroyed. The nation is starving. There is growing resentment among famished civilians over the preferential treatment given to the Japanese military, particularly in terms of food distribution. Also, the emperor has known for 2 months that Russia wants to secure a voice in the future of Asia, a diplomat's wording for impending invasion. But surrender is still not an option for Hirohito. Instead, he clings to the belief that his military leaders will be able to fight off an invasion of the homeland. New airplanes are being built. 29 new army divisions are being formed. Tanks and artillery are being stockpiled for the crucial battle. If we hold out long enough in this war, Hirohito believes, then we may be able to win. Footnote: the Japanese had been preparing defenses and massing troops on Kyushu since early in 1945. An estimated 750,000 troops were massed around the beachheads in anticipation of the American invasion. Despite heavy aerial bombardment, Japan's factories were still functioning and capable of building new weapons of war, staffed by Japanese laborers and Allied POWs. End footnote. It is Saturday on Okinawa, the Sabbath for PFC Desmond Doss. It is to be a day of rest and prayer, even amid the ongoing battle for the Maeda Escarpment. His leg is bruised and bleeding from falling over the side of the cliff last night, and he can barely stand. As the sun rises, Doss leans back against a rock, thinking of his girlfriend back home and reading his Bible. A week has passed since Doss's squad launched their attack. The seesaw battle for the escarpment continues. The Japanese are utilizing a reverse slope defense, in which the Americans are allowed to occupy the forward portions of the summit, but the crest and the reverse side of the mountain remain in Japanese hands. In the process, the Americans have been pushed off the summit many times, only to fight back and regain the high ground. Each day, PFC Doss has climbed the great rope ladders to treat the American wounded. His uniform has turned the color of dried blood from all the men he has treated, frantically performing first aid amid grenades and small arms fire. Doss refuses to seek cover as he applies tourniquets, stanches blood flow, injects morphine, and drags men from the line of fire. B Company has been reduced from 200 to 155 men, and it is Doss who has tended to each of the fallen. Alive or dead, he has lowered their bodies off the escarpment to safety. As Doss reclines in the shade, a colonel suddenly stands over him. Senior officers have no place on the front lines, so this man's appearance is highly unusual. "How are things up there on the hill?" the colonel asks as Doss struggles to rise to his feet. Seeing that Doss's leg is injured, the colonel motions for him to sit back down.
"I haven't been up there this morning, sir."
"I want to see how our artillery is doing," the colonel replies, then walks over and begins climbing the cargo nets to the top. Doss watches the colonel clamber unsteadily up into the combat zone. It seems like just a matter of seconds before the cry of "Medic!" is shouted down over the side. Despite the Sabbath, Doss quickly climbs up the rope ladder and comes upon the listless colonel lying on a rock, badly shot up. The officer is losing blood rapidly. Doss compresses the wound with a surgical dressing, then pulls a liter of plasma from his first aid bag. Around him, the men of B Company lay down suppressing fire to protect Doss. The medic pokes a transfusion needle into a vein. In order for the plasma to flow into the colonel's body, the bag must be elevated. The private rises up from his crouched position. Kneeling, exposed to fire, he holds aloft the plasma bag. A litter arrives. The colonel is eased over the side of the cliff, alive thanks to Desmond Doss. But not for long. The colonel dies before reaching the rear aid station. Doss's wounded leg throbs, but he remains on the summit. The company has no other medic. An American attack on a well-fortified pillbox fails, and more men fall. The dead and dying are spread out across the escarpment as the order to fall back is issued. Every able soldier retreats to safety, scrambling back down the cargo net. Left atop the cliff are Doss, 100 wounded Americans, and the Imperial Japanese Army. Doss refuses to leave. "I knew these men. They were my buddies. Some had wives and children. If they were hurt, I wanted to be there to take care of them," Doss would later write. Working tirelessly, exposed to thick gunfire and exploding shells, the private treats every one of the fallen. The wounded who can shoot provide covering fire as they await their turn to be rescued. Ignoring the searing pain in his leg, Doss grabs each of them under the shoulders or by the heels and drags them to the edge of the cliff. As a child, Desmond Doss once helped rescue victims of a flood. It was then that he was taught a special knot with which he could fashion a sling using a short section of rope. The memory of that knot, something that he had not thought of for 20 years, suddenly comes back to him. Using this impromptu technique, Doss lowers man after man over the side, then rushes back across the escarpment to get another. "Just get one more," he says to himself over and over. "Just one more." Japanese soldiers take aim at Doss, but they miss. When they advance with bayonets, sometimes coming within just a few feet of the medic, wounded Americans summon the strength to shoot the Japanese soldiers dead. By nightfall, PFC Desmond Doss has single-handedly saved the lives of 75 men.
"I can state without reservation that the actions of this man were the most outstanding display of bravery I have ever seen," First Lieutenant Cecil Gornto will marvel.
"I wasn't trying to be a hero," Doss will tell the newspaper reporter much later in his life. I was thinking about it from this standpoint. In a house on fire, and a mother has a child in that house, what prompts her to go in and get that child? Love, he will respond, answering his own question. I loved my men and they loved me. I just couldn't give them up, just like a mother couldn't give up the child.
Footnote. 2 weeks later, on May 21, 1945, a grenade exploded against the bottom of PFC Doss's boot. Severely injured, he bandaged his own wounds, then waited several hours while other wounded men were rescued before allowing himself to be placed on a stretcher. On the way back to the aid station, he suffered a compound fracture when hit by Japanese sniper fire. Using a rifle for a splint, Doss ignored the bone protruding from his arm and crawled to safety. Doss spent the remainder of the war in the hospital. While there, he realized that he had lost his Bible in the thick of battle. When word got back to his unit, the soldiers conducted a thorough search of the Maeda escarpment once the battle was won. They did not stop searching until Doss's Bible was found. Doss received the Medal of Honor from President Harry Truman at a White House ceremony on October 12, 1945, the first non-combatant to receive the nation's highest military award for valor. Doss then spent the next 5 years in and out of the hospital receiving treatment for his many wounds. Doss had dreams of becoming a florist, but his injuries and the loss of a lung to tuberculosis made regular employment impossible. Desmond Doss died on March 23, 2006, at the age of 87. End footnote. Thanks to the courage of men like PFC Desmond Doss, the Battle of Okinawa is finally won. The date is June 23, 1945. Due to its proximity to Japan, the island now becomes the staging point for the invasion. The battle for Okinawa has raged for 82 days. More than 20,000 Americans are dead. Of the 500,000 Americans who came ashore, 1/3 have either been killed or wounded. America did not enter this war by choice, but the days when men fought to avenge the tragedy of Pearl Harbor are long since past. The world will not be safe until Japan is defeated. Yet Japan has not capitulated to another nation in more than 2,000 years. Emperor Hirohito has the power to change all that. He refuses. Hirohito's nation is certainly defeated. The emperor's subjects are bleeding and destitute. Their land is aflame. But Hirohito is not even contemplating surrender to the hated Americans. However, unbeknownst to the emperor, a force more powerful than any he has ever experienced is about to be unleashed. The horror of the atomic age will begin in exactly 44 days. 12. Gora Hotel, Hakone, Japan, June 24, 1945, 7 p.m. A light summer wind brings refreshment to a doomed nation. In the shadow of the snow-capped volcano Mount Fuji, on an evening when the springtime cherry blossoms have long since fallen from the trees, former Japanese Prime Minister Koki Hirota is desperate, though trying very hard not to appear that way. 3 years from now, he will hang by the neck until dead for his part in horrendous Japanese war crimes, but tonight, Hirota is attempting to perform the humanitarian act of ending the war, albeit on Japan's terms. Yet he cannot do this without help from the Russians, which is why the Soviet ambassador to Japan, Yakov Malik, now sits opposite him. The Gora Hotel is 50 miles southwest of Tokyo in the town of Hakone, making it an unlikely spot for a high-level negotiation, but this is the Russians' choice. He far prefers Hakone to the Japanese capital. Malik enjoys the famous local onsen, hot springs, but more important, he appreciates that this wooded resort would be an odd target for American bombers. The 67-year-old Hirota is a slender man with a thin mustache, a lifelong diplomat skilled in the deft words and subtle innuendo required of professional statesmen. Malik is broad and gruff,
a 39-year-old foreign affairs officer whose diplomatic talent is of the more brusque Russian variety. His natural arrogance is heightened by his awareness that the Japanese are dealing from a position of great weakness. The Russians have already declared that they will not renew their 1941 non-aggression pact with Japan on the grounds that the Nippon alliance with Germany makes them an enemy of the Soviet Union. Every day, 30 trainloads of Russian troops and tanks travel to Manchuria in anticipation of a late summer offensive that the Japanese naively believe will never take place. This misjudgment has led Emperor Hirohito to shift thousands of Japanese troops from Manchuria back to defend the home islands, allowing the Russians to move right in. As a veteran negotiator, Hirota knows better than to address the obvious. The emperor himself has authorized this discussion. The fall of Okinawa has made Hirohito desperate to find a way to convince Malik to help Japan seek peace. But the former prime minister has been ordered to proceed as if there is no sense of urgency about ending the war, when in fact, the Japanese need an answer from the Russians almost immediately. Hirota begins by skirting the issue of peace, making a half-hearted joke about a new military alliance between the Imperial Japanese Army and the Red Army. "Our future relations," Malik bluntly replies in a subtle reminder that Russo-Japanese history has been fraught with conflict, "will have to be based on concrete actions." With that, the meeting abruptly comes to an end. A desperate Hirota successfully requests a second session just hours later. He begins by feinting in a new direction, offering to enter into a trade agreement with the Soviets, Japanese rubber and lead from its conquered territories in Southeast Asia in exchange for Soviet oil. "Russia has no oil to spare," Malik replies, his thick face impassive. Having no other choice, Hirota finally gets down to business. "Japan," Hirota admits, "seeks an early peace." This is an astounding statement, overturning more than a decade of Japanese aggression and effectively ending its attempts to build an Asian empire. Yet if Malik is aware that he has just been a party to history, he shows no sign of it.
"His Excellency Mr. Hirota must be well aware that peace does not depend upon Russia."
The Americans and British have publicly stated that World War II will only be finished when the Axis powers unconditionally surrender. Thus, the war in Europe did not end until Germany was completely crushed. "Unconditional surrender will only mean that our national structure and our people will be destroyed," is how Naval Admiral Kantaro Suzuki explained the matter to Emperor Hirohito. "Tonight's negotiations are not just about the future of Japan, but also about the survival of the 2,500-year-old imperial tradition." However, if the Soviets can intercede on behalf of Japan, convincing the United States and Great Britain that unconditional surrender is unnecessary, that humiliation may be averted. Instead of giving up, Japan simply wants to stop fighting. They do not plan on returning the lands they have already conquered in Southeast Asia and China. They also wish to be spared the fate of Nazi Germany, which now endures the indignity of being occupied by American, Russian, French, and British troops, its former leaders soon to be put on trial for war crimes. The punishment for such transgressions, as Koki Hirota well knows, is usually death. Hirota desperately needs the Russians' help to make this outcome possible. But that will not happen. Ambassador Malik will not give him the answer he wants. In fact, the Russian refuses to give any answer at all. The two men talk well into the night, ending their discussion with a round of coffee and liqueurs. The mood is cordial, if strained. A frustrated Koki Hirota returns to Tokyo, the future of his nation and his emperor still uncertain. He longs to quit these frustrating negotiations, for in his gut, Hirota knows that the Russians will never intervene on behalf of Japan. Japan, the aggressor nation, will not survive. And neither will Koki Hirota. Footnote: Hirota was Prime Minister of Japan in 1937, shortly before the Second Sino-Japanese War began in July of that year. After World War II, he was prosecuted for war crimes based on his knowledge of and tacit complicity in the rape of Nanking. The Tokyo War Crimes Tribunal convened in April 1946. Hirota was hanged at Tokyo's Sugamo Prison on December 23, 1948. End footnote. 13. Alamogordo, New Mexico, July 16, 1945, 1 a.m. Robert Oppenheimer paces, a mug of coffee in one hand and a hand-rolled cigarette in the other. Sunday night has become Monday morning. His face is lined, his every movement betraying extreme tension. A hard rain hammers the tin roof above him. Outside this mess hall, lightning crackles and 30-mile-per-hour winds lash the former cattle ranch, now known simply as Base Camp. In less than 3 hours, the Trinity A-bomb test is due to take place 10 miles from where Oppenheimer now fidgets. 5 armed guards stand watch at the base of the tower containing Oppenheimer's precious gadget, making sure that absolutely no one touches or meddles with the explosive. These soldiers will remain there until 30 minutes before the detonation, then get into jeeps and drive away as quickly as possible. Since a weapon like this has never been exploded before, not even a great scientific mind like Oppenheimer knows how big or far-ranging the blast will be. But there can be no test unless this storm ends. It is anticipated that the bomb will release deadly radioactive particles into the air. Scientists have long known that these waste products of a nuclear reaction are hazardous to human life. High winds would carry them across the desert to urban areas, and rain would intensify the damage by saturating the ground with radioactive fallout. Rough weather would also prohibit observation aircraft from taking off, and on a very practical level, rain might ruin the electrical connections necessary to the bomb's detonation. Throughout the night, Oppenheimer has tried to calm himself. He ignored questions that he go to his tent and sleep, instead remaining in the dining hall. At first, he attempted to sit still and read from a book of poetry, but that has proven impossible. Cigarettes and black coffee are his only solace right now. Robert Oppenheimer has the power to create a literal hell on earth, but he has no authority over the heavens. This annoys him greatly. General Leslie Groves appears out of the gale. The Manhattan Project's chief executive is adamantly opposed to a postponement, despite the weather. The general's motives are less scientific than political. Right now, halfway around the world in a small town outside Berlin known as Potsdam, President Harry Truman is attending a summit meeting with Soviet leader Joseph Stalin and British Prime Minister Winston Churchill. A successful on-time detonation of the A-bomb at 4 a.m. will immediately be relayed to Truman, who can then share the news about the dawn of the nuclear era over lunch with his fellow world leaders. To the 70-year-old Churchill, this will come as a triumph, for he has known about the Manhattan Project all along. For Stalin, however, the news is meant to shock and deter. America's possession of an atomic bomb will be a vivid warning to the Russian leader that he will be the weaker partner in any future U.S.-Russian negotiations. The 4 a.m. detonation time has been chosen because secrecy is still vital to the success of the Manhattan Project. Any potential observers will be sleeping as the white light turns the pitch-black desert night into sudden daytime, if only for an instant. Groves, who is just as nervous as Oppenheimer, has managed only a few hours of fitful sleep in his own nearby tent. He is now up for the night. The two men confer. They agree that passing the hours in the base camp dining hall is no way to prepare for the testing of a nuclear bomb. So they step out in the darkness and drive 4 miles closer to the bomb site. There, at the half-buried command post known as the control dugout, where a small group of technicians and scientists vital to the detonation make last-minute adjustments, Oppenheimer and Groves reluctantly agree to postpone the Trinity explosion, but only by an hour. More than 5,000 miles away in Potsdam, there is also a delay. Harry Truman sits down with Winston Churchill at the same time Oppenheimer and Groves are hunkered together in the control dugout. Truman's lodging in the mansion at No. 2 Kaiserstrasse is plush and ornate, an opulence that does not suit his homespun style. The crucial post-war conference among the world's three most powerful leaders has been postponed indefinitely because Joseph Stalin is nowhere to be found, which gives Truman and Churchill time to get to know each other. Truman's early days in office were tentative. He merely reacted to the overwhelming events and decisions that had suddenly been thrust upon him. But now, as a noticeably weary Churchill meets with Truman at precisely 11 a.m. German time, Truman has found his stride. Rather than be awed by a masterful statesman like Churchill, Truman feels himself to be the man's equal as they spend 2 hours in conversation. There is no discussion of the A-bomb testing taking place far away in New Mexico, nor is there talk of a recently intercepted message to the Japanese ambassador to the Soviet Union from his superiors in Tokyo. In the coded communique, Ambassador Naotake Sato insists that Japan will never accept unconditional surrender. They do not discuss these topics because it is likely the Russians have planted listening devices at Truman's residence. As Churchill and his small entourage take their leave, there is a shocking development unfolding in London. Little does either man know it, but they will never have the chance to enjoy a working relationship. The results have not yet been announced in London, but war-weary voters in Great Britain have chosen not to re-elect Winston Churchill. First, the death of Franklin Roosevelt, and now the ouster of Churchill have cut the list of active Allied wartime leaders down to just two men, Harry S. Truman and Joseph Stalin. These two adversaries who still pretend to be allies will now forge a whole new world. Footnote: Churchill's approval rating stood at 83% in May 1945, but he was such an effective war leader that many in Britain feared he might begin a war against the Soviet Union rather than putting an end to the fighting once the Japanese were defeated. With the war in Europe over, the nation turned its focus to rebuilding. British voters were enchanted by the socialist policies of Clement Attlee's Labour Party, whose slogan was, "Let us face the future," and promised to nationalize industries to benefit the working man, causing Churchill's Conservative Party to lose in a landslide. The lifelong politician was later again elected Prime Minister and served from 1951 to 1955, finally leaving office at the age of 80 due to deteriorating health. End footnote. As Winston Churchill departs No. 2 Kaiserstrasse in Potsdam, the Trinity detonation in New Mexico is postponed once again. The blast is rescheduled for 5:30 a.m. With the summer storm now passing, to the immense relief of Robert Oppenheimer and General Leslie Groves, it appears there will be no further delays. Groves leaves Oppenheimer at the control dugout, preferring to drive back to the relative safety of base camp. If the blast is as enormous as some fear, there is no telling whether the control dugout will be consumed or not. At precisely 5 a.m., Ground Zero for Trinity is evacuated. The five soldiers standing guard at the base of the 100-foot tower containing the bomb quickly hustle to their jeeps and race southwest toward base camp. They must drive aggressively over the rough desert roads if they are to arrive before the detonation. In the event of engine trouble, the guards will have a 30-minute head start on the explosion. "I was sure they would not walk slowly," General Groves will later write with wry understatement. In the event that the erstwhile guards are still in the open when the A-bomb goes off, they have been told to lie face down on the ground with their feet toward the explosion. They are not to open their eyes or look at the light in any way, for it has been predicted that the flash will be so brilliant as to blind them. By 5:05 a.m., 0-25 minutes until the detonation, the storm's violent winds have died down to a calm breeze. A light drizzle speckles the desert sand. The cloud cover is still too thick to see many stars and will certainly hamper the observation planes. Robert Oppenheimer leaves the safety of the control dugout's thick concrete walls. He steps into the fragrant pre-dawn air and stands alone. It has been agreed that base camp is the only place where observers can stand in the open to witness the blast, but Oppenheimer plans to ignore that mandate. There are two other bunkers just like the control dugout, each situated 6 miles from the blast site. Both have been covered with dirt to absorb the blast force. Teams of scientists stand ready in these bunkers to analyze the amount of energy released by the explosion and determine whether the bomb detonates in a symmetrical manner. That is, if the A-bomb explodes at all. A few days ago, a practice test of the electronic circuitry that would spark the detonation failed miserably. Oppenheimer's engineers have promised him there will be no problem this morning. Nevertheless, Oppenheimer has made a friendly wager of $10 with physical chemistry engineer George Kistiakowsky, betting that Trinity will fail to detonate. The desert air smells of sagebrush. Morning's first rays of sunshine are limning the horizon. Trinity's test site here in the Jornada del Muerto is a flat patch of desert 18 by 24 miles wide. Oppenheimer stares out across that broad expanse, his stomach aching from anxiety and too many cups of coffee. 5 miles in the distance, he can clearly see the brightly lit tower containing his gadget. He cannot see the bomb itself, but he knows that it is a round sphere 10 feet across, wrapped in a tight coil of wiring. Oppenheimer himself oversaw the moment 12 hours ago when the bomb was hoisted from ground level to the top of the tower. Inside the control dugout, Oppenheimer's team of scientists is behaving in an almost giddy fashion, some slathering on sunscreen in anticipation of the explosion's bright light, others laying down bets as to whether or not the bomb will light the clouds on fire. Yet no one, not even Robert Oppenheimer, knows exactly what will happen. An announcement over a nearby loudspeaker breaks the desert silence. 0-20 minutes. Robert Oppenheimer gazes at his bomb and waits. Harry Truman looks out over a most amazing sight. The entire American 2nd Armored Division standing in formation awaiting his review. Soldiers, half-tracks and battle-tested Sherman tanks line the German Autobahn just outside Berlin, the olive-drab uniforms of American soldiers stretching as far as the eye can see. Truman's meeting with Winston Churchill behind him, he now plans to spend the afternoon exploring bombed-out Berlin. But first, the president will enjoy the great privilege of reviewing his conquering army. An old soldier himself, Truman clambers out of his presidential limousine and stands atop a half-track where the crowd can see him. Footnote: Truman was an artillery officer in World War I. His unit provided fire support for Patton's tank brigade in the Meuse-Argonne offensive. Also in that battle was a soldier from Brooklyn named John O'Reilly, grandfather of Bill O'Reilly. End footnote. As the armored vehicle drives slowly past the troops, Truman is overwhelmed at this display of power. The 2nd is the largest armored division on Earth, a force that has seen action in North Africa, Sicily, and Normandy, and in the battles across Europe that culminated with the German surrender 2 months ago. Yet as President Harry Truman looks down into the faces of these brave men, many of them just a year out of high school, he knows that the 2nd Armored's war may not be over. Already 1 million men comprising 30 divisions are making their way around the world to fight the Japanese. It might be only a matter of weeks until the men of the 2nd board troop ships heading for the Pacific. That is, unless Harry Truman can find another way to convince the Japanese to accept unconditional surrender. At base camp, General Leslie Groves lies in one of the small trenches bulldozed into the earth for blast protection. The time is 0-5 minutes, or 5:25 a.m. All around him, scientists press their faces into the earth. Each clutches a small piece of Lincoln's super-visibility welder's glass, specially designed to protect the eyes from extremely bright light. At the sound of the blast, they will be allowed to roll over, sit up, and through this special glass, witnessed the world's first atomic bomb explosion. Groves, ever nervous, finds the quiet to be intense. I thought only of what I would do if, when the countdown got to zero, nothing happened, he later admits. 4 miles closer to the impending blast, Robert Oppenheimer feels time slow down. The sensation is tortuous. So much rides on the events of these next 5 minutes. Lord, he says aloud, having temporarily stepped back into the control room, these affairs are hard on the heart. Brigadier General Thomas F. Farrell, Groves's executive officer, cannot help but notice Oppenheimer's anguish. Dr. Oppenheimer, on whom had rested a very heavy burden, grew tense as the last seconds ticked off. He could barely breathe. He held onto a post to steady himself. For the last few seconds, he stared straight ahead. With 2 minutes to go, a flare is launched to inform one and all that the explosion is near. Oppenheimer once again steps outside the control bunker and lies face down on the ground next to his brother Frank. Footnote: 32-year-old Frank Oppenheimer, a particle physicist, is a scientific director for the Manhattan Project. He has spent the war at various research facilities and only came to Los Alamos for the final weeks leading up to Trinity. End footnote. At 30 seconds to detonation, the console panel in the control dugout lights up bright red as electrical impulses begin flooding into the bomb. There is still a small chance that the explosion might be scrubbed, but only in the event of electrical difficulties. At 10 seconds, a loud gong echoes through the control dugout as a last reminder for every man to steel himself for what is about to happen. Chicago physicist Sam Allison, the voice of the control tower, counts down the final seconds. 3, 2, 1, now! A tremendous light fills the sky, a brightness so intense that those who see it will talk about it for the rest of their lives. The light of the first flash penetrated and came up from the ground through one's lids, Frank Oppenheimer will remember. When one first looked up, one saw the fireball, and then almost immediately afterwards, the unearthly hovering cloud. That cloud is purple, radiating heat that can be felt miles away. It was like opening a hot oven with the sun coming out like a sunrise, in the words of one observer at base camp. 100 seconds later, an enormous boom erupts as a shockwave follows the explosion. About like the crack of a 5-inch anti-aircraft gun at 100 yards, in the eyes of a watching ballistics expert. The explosion is so powerful that more than 180 miles away in Silver City, New Mexico, 2 large plate glass windows shatter. At the control dugout, the blast bowls over George Kistiakowski, the man with whom Oppenheimer made a bet that the bomb would not detonate. "You owe me $10!" he screams to Oppenheimer, who is suddenly lighthearted and relaxed. "I'll never forget his walk," one scientist will remember of Oppenheimer after the blast. "His walk was like high noon, this kind of strut." He had done it. At the same time Oppenheimer's bomb explodes in New Mexico, 1,200 miles west in San Francisco, the men of the USS Indianapolis are buzzing about the top-secret cargo that has been lifted aboard in the dead of night. At 4 a.m., 2 Army trucks pulled up to the dock. One contained a 15-foot crate, and the other a small tube. Bosun's mate Louis DeBernardi directs the work party that now places straps around the crate so that the gantry crane might lift it on board. Meanwhile, 2 sailors hoist the small cylinder onto their shoulders by running a crowbar through a small eyelet on the tube, then walk the cylinder onto the USS Indianapolis. Curious crew members gossip about what might be coming aboard. Just a few days ago, a shipment of 2,500 life jackets was loaded onto the ship, twice the number needed for the 1,200-man crew. While the men saw that as a routine military screw-up, this new cargo is obviously of a much more serious nature. The crate is secured onto the hangar deck in the middle of the Indianapolis. The cylinder is brought into an empty officer's cabin, where it is lowered onto hinged metal straps that have been welded to the floor. The hinges are closed and padlocked. I didn't think we were going to be using BW, bacterial warfare, in this war, remarks Captain Charles McVeigh III, who has been told nothing about the contents of either package. His orders are to transport the material with all due haste across the Pacific. The Indianapolis was specifically chosen for her size. As a heavy cruiser, she is large enough to carry such a load, but also much faster than vessels of greater tonnage. Yet Cherub McVeigh, as the 46-year-old career officer was known at the U.S. Naval Academy, has been given very specific instructions. No one must go near it except the Marine Guards who will stand watch day and night. If the ship should sink, these packages should be placed in a lifeboat and saved at all costs. If the Indianapolis comes under attack and is in the unlikely danger of being boarded by the enemy, he is to jettison everything overboard to keep it out of Japanese hands. McVeigh knows better than to ask questions. 4 hours later, at 8 a.m., the Indianapolis sails from her berth at the port in San Francisco known as Hunter's Point. By 8:36 a.m., she passes beneath the Golden Gate Bridge and then beside the Marin Headlands out to sea. Her first stop is Pearl Harbor, where she will deposit the few passengers now catching a lift to the war zone. After that, Indianapolis will return to sea. Next stop, Tinian Island. Because of the successful Trinity test, scientists now know that the A-bomb material being shipped across the Pacific will produce the explosive force of 19,000 tons of dynamite. In addition to the atomic bomb tested in New Mexico, American scientists have built two other A-bombs. One of them is now aboard the Indianapolis. The plutonium core of the other is just days away from being flown to the island of Tinian. Neither bomb is yet armed. Robert Oppenheimer and his crew have discovered that the great fireball will shoot up to a height of over 40,000 feet, sucking up great clouds of dust as it ascends. Even as the giant flames faded, northward winds in New Mexico carried radioactive dust across the desert. Alarmingly, the herds of cattle grazing just beyond the blast zone will soon suffer the loss of their hair, indicating that radiation levels around the site are a threat to human life. Back at Ground Zero, the steel tower on which the gadget was perched is gone, completely vaporized. There is not much of a crater. Instead, the blast has traveled up and out from the ground. For a quarter mile around the blast site, the earth is scorched black. The extreme heat has melted the sand into green glass, a material soon to be known as trinitite. Of course, such a horrific explosion and burst of light did not go unnoticed. Answering inquiries, the military responds that an ammunition dump at Alamogordo Army Airfield had caught fire. However, those who can tell the difference between a simple explosion and an earth-shaking bang of epic proportions find this difficult to believe. In New Mexico and Texas, newspapers immediately published stories speculating about what happened. As far away as California, radio broadcasts wonder about the strange events in the New Mexico desert. News spreads up the coast to the state of Washington, where employees at the Hanford Engineer Works quickly deduce that an A-bomb has been detonated. Like Los Alamos, Hanford is a top-secret Manhattan Project facility charged with manufacturing plutonium, a vital ingredient in a nuclear explosion. At almost 8 p.m. in Potsdam, more than 7 hours after the Trinity detonation, Secretary of War Henry Stimson hands Truman a coded telegram announcing its success. Operated on this morning. Diagnosis not yet complete, but results seem satisfactory and already exceeds expectations. Harry Truman's reaction to the news is guarded, pending specifics about the breadth of the blast. In truth, the president is a mere observer of whatever comes next with the A-bomb. He came to the party late, years after FDR foresaw the potential for a nuclear weapon and approved the Manhattan Project. A former World War I artillery officer, Truman sees the bomb as a weapon of war, one with far greater killing capacity than a tank or a missile, but a conventional weapon nonetheless. While he realizes the war's equation has changed in his favor, he does not yet grasp that Trinity is not just a bomb, but also a split-second explosion that has changed the future of mankind. From this day forward, any nation, no matter how small, in possession of a nuclear device, can unleash the bowels of hell any time it wishes. As for sharing the news about Trinity with Joseph Stalin wherever he might be, that can wait. Footnote: Stalin was late for two reasons. First, he wanted to show up Truman, letting his tardiness indicate that he was the more powerful of the two men. Second, deeply afraid of flying, the Soviet leader chose to travel 1,000 miles by train through territory that until very recently had been an active combat zone, with all the precautions that entailed. End footnote. Robert Oppenheimer drinks a brandy at base camp and sends his own special coded message back to his wife Kitty, who has recently returned to him from Pittsburgh. Oppenheimer chooses words that he had already told her would signal success. "You can change the sheets." Oppenheimer's euphoria and relief cannot be measured. Unlike President Truman, he is cognizant of the A-bomb's wider implications. He is already haunted by what he saw today, calling it terrifying, but at the same time recognizes the good in what he has accomplished. As he later tells a reporter, "Lots of boys not grown up yet will owe their life to it." For General Leslie Groves, the Trinity explosion is not the end of a job, as it is for Robert Oppenheimer. Instead, it is a stepping stone to his final objective, which is why he immediately boards a plane for Washington, D.C. "They were still upset by what they had seen and could talk of little else," Groves wrote of the handful of scientists who joined him on the flight back east. "I learned later that the effects of the test on all who had witnessed it, particularly the scientists, were quite profound for a number of days. As for me, my thoughts were now completely wrapped up with the preparations for the coming climax with Japan." It will be a deadly and destructive climax, as an ungodly force will soon be unleashed on the land of the rising sun. 14. Kurei, Japan, July 16, 1945, 0600 hours. Just 12 miles south of the Japanese port of Hiroshima, the Japanese submarine I-58 slips her berth and glides from the port of Kurei, loaded with enough food, torpedoes, and diesel fuel to remain at sea for 1 month. The rising sun emblem is painted boldly in red and white on her gray conning tower. Above it, perhaps even more patriotically, is painted the Kikusui floating chrysanthemum battle standard, in homage to a medieval Japanese warrior who fought to the death against impossible odds for the glory of the emperor. A muggy, warm day is developing as Lieutenant Commander Muchitsura Hashimoto stands at the helm of his submarine. I-58 quickly clears the harbor and enters the inland sea that divides Japan's many islands. The sub leaves behind a city in ruins. 3 weeks ago, 162 American B-29 bombers laid siege to Kurei, sinking two submarines still under construction and heavily damaging another. Several bombs came close to hitting I-58, but she survived unscathed. For the 35-year-old Hashimoto, the fact that his ship has been spared is a source of great relief, second only to the good news that his wife and three sons also lived through the barrage. American B-29s have begun dropping mines across the entrance to Japan's great ports, closing every harbor on the Pacific and a great number on the Sea of Japan. The mine campaign will effectively isolate the nation from the rest of the world. Hashimoto is pleased that his vessel is getting away from the homeland before Kurei Harbor can be mined, for he knows that American planes now dominate the skies over Japan. It is not just the heavy bombers of the Army Air Forces that are pushing Japan. Footnote: It was not until September 18, 1947 that the U.S. Air Force became a separate entity. Army personnel controlled the Air Force during World War II. End footnote. Beginning 6 days ago, on July 10th, the United States Navy has taken advantage of newly opened airfields on Okinawa to launch a steady stream of aerial attacks. Naval aviators are now flying hundreds of sorties a day over the Japanese mainland, destroying the nation's shipping, railways, and limited aerial defenses. Instead of the behemoth silver B-29s that drop their payload from thousands of feet in the air, many aviators fly so low that the Japanese people actually duck as the fighter bombers thunder overhead. Often they can clearly see the pilots' faces. American power is slowly crushing Japan's national morale. A cruel blow came just 2 days ago. 8 ferries carrying coal from the island of Hokkaido to Honshu were sunk, with great loss of life. This leaves Japan with no vessels capable of transporting coal from the mines of Hokkaido to the Japanese factories that rely on them for power to run their machinery. Without factories, there can be no bombs, guns, planes, or tanks to fuel the Japanese war effort. Yet even if the factories could find another energy source, production is all but finished. Industrial leaders are now informing Japan's military leaders that they can produce weaponry for just a few days more for lack of raw material. The psychological toll on the Japanese people is also a liability, yet they represent the nation's last chance for a proper defense of the homeland. Hungry, homeless, and increasingly humiliated, the populace is now being ordered to adopt the suicidal Ketsugo strategy, that is, that all Japanese men, women, and children will fight to the death. Many households have already been issued sharpened sticks, and family members are expected to use them when the Americans invade. Footnote: Ketsugo, Operation Decision, was the official policy of defending Japan to the death. As historian William Manchester points out in American Caesar, manning the nation's ground defenses were 2,350,000 regular soldiers, 250,000 garrison troops, and 32 million civilian militiamen, a total of 34,600,000, more than the combined armies of the United States, Great Britain, and Nazi Germany. Their weapons included ancient bronze cannon, muzzle-loading muskets, bamboo spears, and bows and arrows. Even little children had been trained to strap explosives around their waists, roll under tank treads, and blow themselves up. They were called Sherman carpets. End footnote. For some Japanese soldiers in the distant battlefields of Asia, it is too late for Ketsugo. They see for themselves that the tide of war has turned. For the first time ever, many Japanese have begun to surrender, mainly because their weapons have been destroyed. From May onwards, prisoners in a terrible state came in daily, many of them armed with nothing more dangerous than bamboo spears and trembling with a mixture of malaria and humiliation, one British soldier in Burma will report. The Japanese war effort is almost on life support. But Muchitsura Hashimoto still commands one of the best submarines in the world. Hashimoto has been in charge of I-58 ever since the state-of-the-art vessel was commissioned in late 1944. She is 356 feet long and 30 feet wide at the beam, making I-58 larger than most American submarines. She carries 19 Type 95 torpedoes, which have an accurate range of almost 6 miles and can travel through the water at more than 40 miles per hour. In addition, I-58's deck gun has been removed to make room for 6 Kaiten torpedoes, 8-ton, 40-foot-long, human-guided suicide missiles that are the underwater version of kamikaze aircraft. Footnote: the Kaiten torpedo was first developed in summer 1944, essentially a one-man submarine with an explosive charge that activated upon ramming another vessel. The Kaiten was launched from a larger host submarine. The program was largely ineffective in comparison with the kamikaze airplane suicide attacks. End footnote. A well-educated man and a graduate of the Imperial Japanese Naval Academy, Hashimoto knows that Germany's surrender means Japan stands alone against the world. More than 2 million soldiers and millions of other citizens stand ready to defend the home islands against invasion, but I-58 and Japan's 5 other operational submarines represent the nation's last great chance to be the attacker instead of the attacked. It has been an adventurous, if frustrating, 10 months since Hashimoto first took the sub to sea. The I-58 has seen action off the coast of Guam and during the battles for Iwo Jima and Okinawa. Her job is to harass the American fleet, launching her Type 95s and Kaitens at vessels anchored offshore in support of the invasions. But it is U.S. pilots who have often done the stalking, attacking I-58 whenever she comes close enough to the surface to fire her arsenal. Hashimoto has been forced to dive deep to save his crew on many occasions. On April 25th, three American destroyers cornered I-58, and there was little Hashimoto and his men could do but wait out the attack from 300 feet beneath the surface. They survived, and afterward were credited with sinking an American tanker and an American aircraft carrier. But it was all a ruse. The truth is, the I-58 had sunk nothing at all. Footnote. The mistake came about because Japanese submarines relied upon the sound of explosions to confirm a sinking, lacking visual confirmation because they were forced to dive soon after firing their torpedoes. This, plus an Imperial Japanese Navy habit of inflating the number of sinkings of American vessels in order to please superiors, often led to false reports. End footnote. The fact that Hashimoto has not destroyed a single American ship is a matter of shame for him. To become a true man of honor, he needs a kill. He hopes that this voyage will erase the lone blemish on an otherwise spotless service record. Enemy ships seem to be everywhere in the Pacific now, offering I-58 a number of targets. Hashimoto's orders are to harass the enemy's communications, giving him the latitude to attack whenever he wants. And with I-58's range of 21,000 nautical miles, this means Hashimoto can travel almost any place in the Pacific that he wishes, a lone wolf in search of a sheep that has strayed from its flock. Hashimoto's crew of 100 officers and men realizes that the war may be over by the time they return to port. They are an elite group, hand-selected for service aboard I-58. The end of the war will surely mean the dissolution of the Imperial Japanese Navy. This, then, will be their last mission. Hashimoto, the son of a Shinto priest, has erected a small shrine on board so that he may seek divine intervention. He prays that somewhere out there is an American ship destined to collide with one of I-58's torpedoes. Soon, his prayer will be answered. "Dive," orders Hashimoto.